Welcome. You're listening to the You're Crazy Professor, But It Might Just Work Amazing Podcast. Episode 37, The Mass Shootings of Derek Bird and Raoul Moat. What a strange summer that was. In June and July of 2010, two major firearms incidents occurred within 31 days of each other. The Cumbrian mass shooting by Derek Bird, followed by the Rothbury spree shooting by Raoul Moat. This was highly unusual for a country with the most stringent firearms regulations in the world, which on average has only one mass shooting every 10 years. I'd also recall my involvement with the media at the time of the week-long manhunt for Raoul Moat and what happened a month before, and look at the methods used by Northumbria Police at the time. And then I think about the recent TV drama about Raoul Moat and how it could encourage some viewers to recreate his extreme violence. On Wednesday the 2nd of June, I'd spent the day in a prison and I came out to find my mobile phone full of messages from journalists asking me questions about a spree shooting that happened in Cumbria earlier that day. I remember one journalist's voice message was quite breathy, and she thought the active shooter was actually a rogue policeman. Inside the prison, I'd been oblivious to the breaking news of 52-year-old taxi driver Derek Bird, who killed 12 people and then injured 11 others. By the time I caught up with the story, it had all been over for hours. After killing his own brother and family solicitor, because Bird was worried they were colluding to take away his inheritance from his late father, Bird then attacked some of his former taxi driver colleagues in Whitehaven, killing one of them, Darren Rucastle, before undertaking a mobile shooting spree, travelling through the villages of South Cumbria in his taxi, shooting at people as he went along. It was the apparent, seemingly randomness of victim selection as he drove through the area that made Bird's hunt more terrifying. Strangers with no connection to Bird were also seen by him as legitimate targets as the attack continued. Pursued by police while using his local knowledge of the roads to stay ahead of them, he ended his life in the village of Boot before he could be caught. The BBC contacted me after my contribution to an ITN Tonight documentary that week about Bird, asking me if I would go to Whitehaven for a live piece to camera from the High Street. Filming studio contributions to documentaries is one thing, but turning up in the middle of a grieving community to do a live interview from the pavement is something else and not what I would call responsible media work for an academic. A month later, something about Bird's rampage had clearly resonated with 37-year-old Raoul Thomas Moat, having just been released from Her Majesty's Prison, Durham, for an assault conviction on a 9-year-old child of his. Moat soon shot and killed perceived love rival Chris Brown, who Moat was sure was a police officer, in the early hours of July the 3rd. This was an ambush he launched on the Gateshead home of his former partner Sam Stobbart, who was also shot and injured. Initial news reports on Sunday described the shooting as a criminal feud. Early next morning, Moat shot and blinded PC David Rathband as he sat in his patrol car a few miles away from Stobbart's home, having called the police to warn them just 12 minutes earlier, complaining he was not being taken seriously by the police. The news narrative now shifted to being a manhunt for someone who was actively attacking and willing to kill police officers. Believing he had killed two police officers, Moat's narcissistic personality speedily compelled him to write a letter, setting the record straight about he believed he was the victim in this story. The 49-page rambling letter was hastily written by the fugitive Moat, and he stated he was planning on shooting only police officers at that point, and he was, quote, not going to be shooting little old ladies in woolly hats like that bloke last month, as a reference to Bird. Although claiming his attack would be different from Bird's and targeted against the police, with a justification that Bird's attack did not have, it's clear that Moat was no doubt influenced by Bird's shooting spree. This is the contagion effect of mass shooting violence in action. And it begs the question, if Bird's attack had not occurred, would Moat's mass shooting attack have occurred either? Arrested on 12 separate occasions previously, Moat believed that Northumbria police victimised him and caused him financial ruin, and being told by his ex-partner Sam that she no longer wanted to see him as she was now seeing a policeman proved too much for Moat to bear. Stobart wasn't in fact seeing a policeman and Chris Brown had no connections to the police, but she was so frightened of Moat that she felt the only way to make him stay away upon release was to tell him that she was dating a police officer. That is a lie that Stobart has said she since regrets telling. Moat had made threats before leaving prison that he was going to harm Stobart, but these were not passed on to the police. And again, Moat's highly narcissistic personality could not tolerate such humiliation, and he felt he was wronged by Stobart and Chris Brown, which in his eyes justified his resort to extreme violence, and which we often call narcissistic injury. The manhunt of a cop killer piqued news outlet interest, and Moat very quickly escalated to front page news, receiving saturation rolling coverage on BBC and Sky News virtually 24/7. Reporters wanted to know about the type of person Moat could be, how other manhunt cases had been resolved, and what could make someone do this kind of violence. Unfortunately, there was no shortage of other similar mass shooting cases that I could refer to when talking to journalists. Moat's own letter to the police was released and provided lots of details to allow for analyses of his thought processes, likely behaviours, and clues how to communicate with him in a way that could end the situation peacefully. The number of interviews I took part in that week was around 15 to 20, TV, radio, print, all needing to fill the gap in coverage while waiting for Moat to surface or for the drama to end. Within his long letter to the police, Moat's narcissism was clearly evident on many levels. He believed he was different from other people. He believed that normal rules did not apply to him. He felt he was not responsible for the situation he was in, and he felt that others were responsible for what had happened to him. His use of violence was justified. The absence of any consequences from his violence reinforced his violent methods from the past. He believed he could persuade others to see any situation his way. He was unable to take reasonable criticism. He had an unstable personality. He took the police actions against him as a personal vendetta. And perhaps most importantly of all, he found it vital that other observers should see him as the victim in the situation, not the villain. Incredibly, Moat also sent a Get Well Soon card to Sam Stobart when he learned that she was in hospital. Within the card, he wrote and explained how he'd not intended to kill her and that her wounds would qualify her for some compensation and that he actually did her a favour because that she could buy something nice for the daughter they had together. Again, these are the words that only a narcissist could write. I remember giving a few live TV interviews on the campus of the university where I worked, and the weather was particularly good that week, so a lot of these interviews were done outdoors because producers felt it added to the outdoors element of the manhunt story. The university press office was certainly helpful in coordinating all the requests that were coming in. Interviews mostly focused on having to correct reporters' assertions that Moat must be mentally ill, he was not, and about the narcissistic nature of well-known mass shooters, and also focusing on what else his letter and card to Stobart could reveal. Moat's letter was an invaluable source, as were the details emerging about his history and his previous involvement with social services. While the police were certain Moat had gone to ground within the nearby countryside, they were less certain about the initial roles played by his two associates, Carl Ness and Karim Awan, in the initial shootings. The police were able to use these men to try and lure Moat into handing himself in. Both Ness and Swan were broadcast on live TV news, being escorted through the countryside by armed police officers, trying to point out areas where Moat may have been. Both men were visibly handcuffed, and it's entirely possible that this was a performative police tactic used to encourage Moat to give himself up. Knowing that he was a narcissistic individual, it would be acceptable for Moat to end his mission if he felt he was saving his associates in a heroic way by giving himself up. However, such televised parades through the countryside did not work, and Moat remained hidden. A second interesting possible deliberate tactic used by the police was in the daily conferences they held, sometimes from a local school in Rothbury. At one press conference, Northumbria Police Temporary Chief Constable Sue Sim read out a card purportedly from a local school pupil, and the card was thanking the police for all their help. Sim read out the card verbatim and she said, "Thank you to the police for keeping us safe from that nutter," which seemed like unusual language for a thank you card written by a child. Later that day, in a clarification at another press conference, Sim apologised to Mr. Moat for the choice of language used earlier and encouraged him to get in touch. Sometimes known as supercop, this is a police method of establishing a trusting relationship between an offender or an unsub and the police, making it easier for any surrender to happen. I always thought it possible that it was also an attempt to goad Moat into breaking cover, knowing that he would not be able to bear such public insults that questioned his sanity or his mental well-being without having to correct the public's perception of him. I believe this was a deliberate attempt to goad Moat into getting in touch and contacting the police. As the week went on, we got to Thursday, the 8th of July, and Northumbria Police now requested a media blackout on the story, as a dictaphone had been found in a tent that Moat had stayed in near Wagtail Farm. The dictaphone recording contained a long, angry rant from Moat about what he had heard on the radio and seen in tabloid papers from experts commenting about him. The recording had been made a couple of days before it was found, and it was clear that the level of scrutiny Moat was under in the news was unbearable for him, especially with the criticisms he did not agree with or that he found unflattering. Moat had now threatened, in the recording, to kill any members of the public who got in his way, and that he would also kill one member of the public for every unflattering piece he heard about himself going forward. So the news blackout was a public necessity. Moat was not unhappy, though, about all of the coverage he received, and he particularly enjoyed the descriptions of his physical size and his fearsome reputation. He liked being described as having a hulking physique, but did not like the allegations that the anabolic androgens he'd used to help achieve such a size had probably made him paranoid and violent. By the time Moat was cornered by the police on Friday the 9th of July in Rothbury, he'd been at large for almost a week and had been the subject of the largest manhunt the UK had known. Given the resources at their disposal, ranging from over 160 armed police officers, assistance from seven other police forces, a famous TV wildlife expert tracker, and a Tornado GR4 with infrared capabilities, Moat succeeded in making the police look like they were on the back foot throughout the investigation. And in short, Moat made the police look pretty stupid, and there were lots of people enjoying this spectacle. I need to clarify here that no experts, psychologists or otherwise, were asked to go on scene and to give the police their assistance. Some experts believe Moat had slipped the police cordon and would be on his way to Europe, and his evasion of the police for almost a week made him an internet anti-hero, and to many who are not fans of the police, even inspiring a Facebook page after his death, Raoul Moat, you legend, rest in peace, with over 18,000 followers by the time it was cancelled. Some compared Moat to Robin Hood, with thousands of pro-Moat social media posts occurring. Many interviews that week also wanted to focus on why some people would actively be rooting for Moat to stay on the run, and it was being made into a class issue by some corners of the press. There are many who look back on that strange week in July 2010 and view it almost like an entertaining game or like the Truman Show. It was so bizarre and became more so towards the end of the hunt that some of it doesn't feel real even to this day. A possible danger in dramatising the story of Moat, no matter how careful or well-intentioned the writers and producers may be, is that if he's portrayed sympathetically, even occasionally, in a flattering light, some viewers may take that as admiration for Moat. After all, like most spree shooters, Moat was not all bad. He was not violent to his children most of the time, who he loved, and friends said he was capable of being fun. Just like the irresponsible news reports of mass shooters and the damage they can do, the same must surely be possible with any such dramatised versions of mass shootings and gun violence. The contagion effect of news coverage of mass shootings could even be amplified when TV dramas risk portraying any attractive or positive aspects of such villains. The influence of news coverage of gun violence is proven by research. Evidence shows that news reports portraying mass shooters as misunderstood, outsiders, or even anti-heroes are harmful and can influence others who've perhaps considered violence and they take action and attack. News which shows video footage of attackers or publicises their social media posts and writings can act as a reward for would-be mass shooters who want attention and infamy. News descriptions of mass shootings often make the perpetrators sound competent, dangerous, important, and hyper-masculine, and this can be alluring for would-be shooters. Research demonstrates that mass shooters who are motivated by a design for infamy, so-called fame-seeking mass shooters, tend to kill more victims than other types of mass shooters who aren't trying to achieve notoriety. Those mass shooters understand a guaranteed way of gaining news infamy and a legacy lies in greater numbers of fatalities. Countless high-profile mass shootings in several countries have been demonstrated to invoke copycat attacks by those who identify with the original shooter. The perpetrator of the worst mass shooting in Tasmania in 1996, Martin Bryant, claimed afterwards he did it because he wanted to beat that record set by Thomas Hamilton in the Dunblane school shooting a month before. The mass shooting in Utøya, Norway, by Anders Breivik in 2011, which killed 69 following his bombing in downtown Oslo, led to copycat attacks in the Czech Republic and Poland in 2012, and the New Zealand mosque attacks in 2019. The Isla Vista mass shooting in California by British-born Elliot Rodger in 2014 has since inspired over 15 other individuals to commit mass shootings or mass killings, all directly citing Rodger's name as an influence. Due to the contagious nature of mass shootings and the large amount of global media attention they receive, it's likely that this will continue to happen until news media change how they report mass violence and gun violence. There'll no doubt be some angry, disaffected young males who may see The Hunt for Raoul Moat and feel some kind of affinity with Moat's portrayal and their own personal setbacks in life or their dislike of the police. Moat's physical appearance, pumped-up size and his anti-hero hyper-masculine status would be impressive to some. It's to be hoped that such viewers won't have access to firearms. As well as the deaths of Chris Brown and Moat himself, it should be remembered that others involved in this story lost their lives too. In October 2010, Peter Boatman, director of Protect, the firm which developed the X-Rep taser weapon used in Moat's final standoff with the police, took his life after having the Home Office licence to supply the tasers removed, having breached the licence by giving the weapons directly to Northumbria police officers at the time. PC David Rathband, who went on to lead the Blue Light Foundation charity, took his life in February 2012, as he was ultimately unable to adjust to the life-changing injuries he sustained at Moat's hands. Although mass shootings are rare, when they occur, the impact upon society and neighbourhoods and communities is huge and lifelong. We need to make sure that the reporting of those crimes is sensibly done, and not always fodder for TV dramas. You've been listening to Your Crazy Professor, But It Might Just Work, Amazing Podcast. I hope this has been useful. I hope it's made you think. Bye-bye.